Got to figure out how to fade that out one of these years.
Welcome to the Fireside. I'm Elsa Bloodyixa, and I'm with by the fire with Swamp Cracker, and this is the Blood and Soil Fireside Chat. In this episode, we'll be discussing a letter by Hans Schmidt of the German-American National Political Action Committee. So grab your favorite beverage and warm yourself by our fire. Now, Mr. Schmidt had an interesting history. He was born in April of 1927, so he was involved in the Hitler Youth organization throughout, you know, the formative years of the Reich. He later, at 16, joined the Waffen-SS in 1943, and he served as a corporal in the SS Division Liebstandarte. He was wounded twice during campaigns in Hungary, Austria, and the Battle of the Bulge. And in 1947, after the fall, he left Germany and emigrated to the United States. Once here, he founded GANPAC, the German-American National Political Action Committee, and put out monthly newsletters. He raised donations to contribute to various political candidates, which obviously, since it was like a uniparty thing even back then, it didn't go very well. And he also founded the German-American Information and Education Association, which was, I think, largely intended to educate people with respect to the true events of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
He was long-term friends with both Ernst Zundel and William Luther Pierce, and he wrote several books, one of which I was able to order off of Amazon.
Aren't you cool? Now you want to tell me all this stuff. You said you had a letter, and that was it.
Well, no, I mean, I had a letter.
I didn't
necessarily say that
was it. That's really cool.
That's
really cool. Yeah,
just, you know, by way of background, it's nice to know a little bit about, you know, who we're hearing from here.
Well, absolutely. It's imperative, actually. You know, what are the chances of this man living, let alone doing stuff after the fact and still being a figure for the National Socialist Movement even after he was done? And then for you to find the letters, like, that's incredible. It fits fits what we're doing, as well as the chances of that person actually being able to write something and it still be around, is like us being on the line at 11 o'clock listening to Headstrong or something, just ironically. That's pretty crazy.
Well, and he actually lived to the ripe old age of 83. He passed away in 2010. This letter was published. Yeah. This letter was published in the Hoskins Report in December of 1993. Mm. So it's been quite a while.
What is a Hoskins Report?
Richard Kelly Hoskins published, I think it was a monthly, actually.
Mm-hmm. Could I put you on the spot? I must have. Is it a mainstream person, or is he a conservative person? As well as a conservative.
Well,
everything is left.
He actually was a CI.
What am I talking about?
He was a CI leader. He just passed away a couple of years ago. But
what's his name?
Richard Kelly Hoskins.
Hoskins. Christian Identity guy?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I've heard the last name, I do believe.
Okay. So with that, I gleaned from, you know, the context, since I didn't actually read the Hoskins report, I just got a copy of the letter, but I gleaned from the context that this was written as sort of like an op-ed piece that was you know, based on a request from Hoskins for, you know, people to provide their, you know, anecdotal sort of, you know, commentary about their life, you know, in Germany during the 30s and 40s.
That's
so without further
awesome.
Ado, he writes, "You asked for someone who had lived in Hitler's Germany to tell what it was like. Permit me, someone who lived under the swastika flag from 1935 when the Tsar was reunited with Germany to 1945 to give a short answer. To be a boy or a girl at that time was wonderful. In the Hitler youth, the differences between Christian denominations or the different German states didn't count. We all truly felt that we were members of one body of people, one nation. Youth hostels were open all over the Reich, enabling us to hike from one beautiful town to another, seeing our fatherland. Every effort was made to strengthen our minds and bodies. Contrary to what is said today, we were encouraged to become free in spirit and not to succumb to peer or authority pressure. In peacetime, no military training was allowed by the Hitler Youth leadership. Scouting, yes. Incidentally, to snitch on our parents was frowned upon. At the very time when America's allies, the Soviets, destroyed most of the Christian churches in Russia and Ukraine, about 2,500 new churches were built in Germany. Not one church was closed. It was the law that school and church had priority over service in the Hitler Youth. As late as fall of 1944, the Waffen-SS barracks in Breslau supplied two buses to take youth to the nearest Catholic or Protestant church every Sunday. To be a registered member of a Christian church did not prevent advancement in the National Socialist Party. Germany was National Socialist, but free enterprise flourished during the entire Hitler years. No company was nationalized. No small businessman was stopped from opening his own store. I myself worked during the war for a company that can only be called part of international capitalism. If you own shares, nobody confiscated them, like the Allies did in 1945. The accomplishments of the, quote, Nazis, close quote, were incredible. Starting without money and with 6 million unemployed, a third of the workforce, they constructed the entire German Autobahn road network in the short span of 6 years, almost without corruption, while seeing to it that the new road system did not unnecessarily destroy either the German landscape or wildlife habitats and forests. 2 years after the NS were elected to power, conditions were so improved that workers had to be hired in nearby friendly countries, to help alleviate the worker shortage in Germany. Germany was booming while Britain, France, and the U.S. were in the depths of the Great Depression. To help the workers get cheap transportation, the Volkswagen was designed and a factory was being built for their manufacturer when the war started. Also, for the common people, villages of small single-family homes were erected. The monthly payments were set so low that almost anyone could afford his own house. In Hitler's Germany, there were no homeless, no beggars. Crime was almost non-existent because habitual criminals were in concentration camps. All this was reported in the newspapers and was known by everybody. The German press during the Third Reich had fewer taboos than the American press does today. The only taboo I can think of evolved around Hitler, and during the war, there was a law that prohibited defeatism. This was because of the negative role the German press played in the German defeat of 1918. It bears remembering that the European Economic Community was first coined by the Third Reich government. I remember many articles, both pro and con, about the subject. One should also not forget that during the war, at least 7 million foreign nationals, nearly 10% of the population, worked in Germany, either as voluntary workers, the Dutch, Danes, French, Poles, Ukrainians come to mind, or as forced laborers or as prisoners. I know of no instance where foreigners were attacked or molested, much less killed, because they were foreigners. Speaking of the press, I have an article from 1943 in my possession that spells out how necessary friendship is between the German and Russian peoples. Between 1933 and 1945, there was a tremendous emphasis on culture. Theaters flourished. The German movie industry produced about 100 feature films per year, of which not one was anti-American. Only 50 of them can be considered pure propaganda movies. Some of the best classical recordings still extant were made in Hitler's Germany. Actors from all over Europe, but mainly from France, Sweden, and Italy, were stars in German movies. Germany always loved sports, and there was no lack of opportunities to partake in any sport one liked. The 1936 Berlin Olympics was merely a showcase of what transpired all over the Reich. In a book on these Olympics issued by Hitler, by the Hitler Youth that is still in my possession, Jesse Owens is shown several times and mentioned favorably. During the Schmeling boxing fights, we kids all knew of Joe Louis, the brown bomber. Nowhere did I ever read derogatory remarks about other races. Certainly, the accomplishments of Germany and the Germans were given prominence, similar to the ad nauseum statements of today that the U.S. is the land of the free, etc. In my 10 years in the Hitler Youth, actually 8, I obviously couldn't attend while a soldier, the Jews were never mentioned. Other sports that gripped our attention were flying. There was a Hitler Youth flying training with their own sailplanes. Car races, British and Italian drivers dominated, and riding. Frequently, I'm asked about gun control during the Hitler era. Claims are made that Hitler could take power because he disarmed the German people. That is nonsense. In Germany, gun ownership was never as prevalent as it is in America. I would say that for hundreds of years, one needed a gun license in order to keep a weapon. On the other hand, my father owned an old pistol clandestinely, about which we children knew, and there were gun clubs all over the Reich. Furthermore, Germany was always a country with many excellent gunsmiths. It is doubtful that they would stay in business if the laws were too stringent. I would surmise that while Germany was Germany before it was, quote, liberated, close quote, by the Allies, gun ownership probably was far more widespread than it is acknowledged today. Laws on the books were mainly to give the police a handle to arrest criminals with guns, not the ordinary citizen. Incidentally, just as Hitler had forbidden so-called punishment exercises in the army, the brutal methods still employed in the American army, so had he forbidden the use of clubs by the police. He considered it demeaning to the German people. Finally, this. I don't think I'll ever see again a people as happy and content as were the great majority of Germans under Hitler, especially in peacetime. Certainly some minorities suffered, former parliamentary politicians because they couldn't play their political games, the Jews because they lost their power over Germany, the gypsies because during the war they were required to work, and crooked union bosses because they lost their parasitical positions. To this day, I believe that the happiness of the majority of the people is more important than the well-being of a few spoiled minorities. In school, there should be emphasis on promoting the best and the intelligent, as was done in Germany during the Hitler years, a fact that contributed after the war to the rapid German reconstruction. That Hitler was loved by his people, there can be no question. Even a few weeks before the war's end and his death, he was able to drive to the front and mingle among the combat soldiers with only minimum security. None of the soldiers had to unload their weapons before meeting with the Führer, as was required when President Bush met with American soldiers during the Gulf War. Germany under Hitler was quite different from what the media would have you believe.
That was interesting. We could dissect that letter over a couple weeks, to be honest with you. I was going to say that could have been – that's really good. 6 years to build the Autobahn. What stood out to me? Of course, Volkswagen, international capitalism. Didn't he say that was flourishing? That was an interesting comment.
Yeah, basically he was saying that there was like a – there's always been the propaganda out there about repression of – or oppression of small business and the nationalization of things. And you know, I'm sure that big steel companies like Krupp's and, you know, Mercedes and, you know, companies like that were receiving subsidies from the government. I mean, everybody was receiving subsidies from the government at that time. But I don't think that, you know, as he said, nothing was nationalized.
Nothing was state-owned?
Correct.
Which is the buzz. Which there is a buzz that Hitler ruled everything. He owned everything. He threw the Jews out of everywhere. The state owned everything.
Well, and I mean, to the extent that people were pressured into selling their interest, or, you know, certain things were confiscated from criminals or whatever, you know, I'm sure what likely happened based on, you know, this letter and other things that I've read is that rather than the state holding that, you know, those interests were sold to the general public so that, you know, those interests would be remain in the hands of you know,
the public,
actual
the
Germans as opposed to diaspora people.
Right. Promoting the best of the and the most intelligent was something else that, you know, caught my ear.
Yeah. Well, in a meritocracy,
something we don't do. You know, if you, what else stood out? Snitching on your parents, just a few of the things that you could tell were just anti-communist. You know,
well,
if you recall, in the United States, the whole snitch movement started. It was a communist deal with Neighborhood Watch, and it just created a vibe of everybody telling on everybody. And now you have Karen.
Well, and you know, if to contrast a little bit, you, this was something that the KGB was infamous for, was, you know, propagandizing that children should tattle on their parents, or, you know, and certainly the Stasi in East Germany after the war. You know, if you recall from 1994 when the wall went down, there was a huge cache of all kinds of intelligence that the Stasi had been, you know, collecting on, you know, just general East Germans. You know, everything from napkins from restaurants and, you know, glasses with fingerprints on them. And I mean, who knows what nefarious purposes they were holding that stuff for.
You know, when our people came to America, Europeans, as they settled, Italians, Germans, Irish, the English, all had just instilled in them. I know we speak of Italians all the time in Omerta, but every neighborhood, every clique, every tribe, every group of people, they didn't tell on each other. The neighborhood, they solved their own problems, and there was a sense of truth. Honor. Neighbor could kick the cat without getting told on.
Not that they would necessarily do that, which is actually one of the things that wasn't really touched on all that in depth in the letter, but the animal rights sort of, you know, laws that were passed, the anti-vivisection laws that were passed in Germany in the 30s, you know, being the first and most progressive of all, you know, pro-humane, you know, type things that we've ever seen. I mean, you know, certainly, you know, our own government has suffered under, you know, this animal experimentation for medical purposes and all this kind of thing, and it completely contrasts, you know, the story. I mean, you hear all of these tales about, you know, medical experiments that were conducted on various individuals, people, you know, and I find it hard to believe that in a nation that would pass such strong anti-vivisection laws that they would deign themselves to instead turn that on to actual human beings. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. But then again, you know, criminals, possibly deviants, those that were in concentration camps. Don't we as a country test on humans?
Well, certainly, you know, we certainly have. I mean, but usually we go to other countries and do it there, like,
right.
You know,
Ukraine.
Anthony Fauci did in the 80s with the AIDS thing and the first mRNA, you know, type medications that they were testing, which was a disaster, by the way.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're more afraid of people finding out and, you know, this information kind of getting out into the public, which gets us into, you know, some of the more interesting, you know, Operation Mockingbird type things, you know, because as that operation is not merely, you know, a method to propagandize, but it's also a means to, you know, prevent certain information from coming out into the public.
This gentleman didn't seem to have a bad life, did he?
Well, I think that he had a difficult one in a lot of ways, but, you know, I don't think that he was embittered by that. You know,
right.
I think that
yeah.
he was focused on, you know, attempting to remove the tarnish on Germany's reputation and, you know, speak for the people who were too afraid to speak or couldn't speak for themselves.
You know, I want to get back to the test on human thing. Do you know that there, we'll call them normies, you know that there are normies out there that would say test on a less fortunate human before you test on a perfectly fine animal?
Yeah.
Well, come on, I'm trying to bait you in.
Well, and I mean, you know, it... This is true. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that there are ways to, you know, develop new medications, develop new treatments, develop, you know, surgical procedures, but do it based on informed consent and not, you know, just randomly sticking stuff in the water or like, you know,
yeah.
like the Tuskegee. The Tuskegee experiments is a perfect example.
You're going to throw that one out there on me like that. Why don't you
yeah.
tell me and anyone that's going to listen, maybe the two guys sitting in the back know what the hell that is, because I don't. What is it? I don't even know how to type it, to spell it. I can't even click on the keyboard. So I'm feeling it. What,
well, okay. So
crime?
For a 40-year period.
Yeah.
In Tuskegee, Alabama, the U.S.
Ooh.
Government, you know, by the United States Public Health Service and the Centers for Disease Control, conducted a syphilis study on 400 African American men.
No. Damn.
And, you know, they were...
Must have been out of prison.
No. The people who were enrolled were 600 impoverished African-American sharecroppers from Macon County, Alabama.
Wow. And they just infected them with syphilis? Consensually.
I don't know if they infected them with syphilis, but it says of these men, 399 of them had latent syphilis with a control group of 201 men who were not infected.
Damn, what are they doing then?
As an incentive for participation in the study, the men were promised free medical care.
They were bribed.
But they were deceived by the public health services because they were never actually informed of their syphilis diagnosis. And
they wouldn't do that to those people, would they?
But they were provided disguised placebos and, you know, ineffective methods and diagnostic procedures like treatment for, quote, bad blood, whatever that means. And they were told that the experiment was only going to last 6 months, but it wound up lasting 40 years. And none of the men were treated with penicillin, even though they knew that antibiotics were the gold standard treatment for treatment of syphilis.
Jesus.
So basically, they just let these men, you know, wallow in it for 40 years.
Golly.
So anyway, that's been, that whole thing has been, you know, highlighted by the African American community as being, you know, one of the greatest showings of systemic racism that ever existed. And I understand it, but I don't necessarily think that, you know, it's an expression of systemic racism. I think it was an expression of a corrupt government, you know, a government that was already rotten by then.
Yeah, it's not based on your skin color, people. It's based on you. It's a caste system. There's and there's them. That's it.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that these were, you know, some of the poorest people out there. You know, they weren't going to complain to anybody, and they, you know, most of them were uneducated. They aren't going to, like, you know how to address this differently, and they couldn't afford to get separate medical treatment, so they just did whatever they told them to do.
This wasn't a problem in National Socialist Germany, was it?
No.
No, of course not. So, you know, I looked at this whole process, the letter, and, you know, this portion of the discussion is kind of like a moving from the darkness into the light, you know, the darkness of the Weimar years that we discussed last time, and, you know, some of the startling similarities that we see today, the inflation, the border incursions, the homelessness, the joblessness, and
inflation,
out of control inflation. And, you know, here, you know, one of the things that they like to say currently is that, oh, well, you know, our, you know, jobs numbers have gone up, and, you know, we've gotten positive reports of that. And yeah, these are people who are basically taking part-time jobs to make ends meet because they can't afford to pay the grocery bill now.
And when jobs go in the toilet so far, anything goes in the toilet so badly, and you come along, anything in the right direction is going to look like you've done something. But
right.
You ain't even got it out of the toilet yet. Everybody forgot about the toilet. It's just barely getting out of the toilet. They ain't created more jobs. It's because there was there was no fucking jobs. Now you created a few. It wasn't like he done anything great.
Well, and this
they never
is what
do
makes,
anything great.
This is what makes Germany's recovery so incredible, actually, because of the fact that, you know, when you look at inflation, all right, the economics of inflation, it isn't just when you see, you know, the number drop to, oh, inflation isn't increasing anymore, or, you know, it's like it went from, you know, 10% year over year to like 1%, yay, you know. The fact of the matter is that those numbers are still increasing. They may be increasing by less, but you are not as well off as you were prior to that rapid, you know, inflation occurring. You would have to have several years worth of deflation, right, in order to bring things back down to a buying power sort of normal, you know? And this is what people don't understand. It's like, you know, the news tells them, oh, well, you know, inflation is down this month, and it's like, okay, so you're not actually saying that inflation is being reduced. You're saying that inflation is going up by less. This is a very important distinction.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that National Socialist Germany was able, during the Great Depression, right, to create this nation, essentially, where nobody was homeless, nobody was hungry, people could buy their own homes. You know,
almost everybody could afford to buy their own house.
Everybody could afford to buy their own house. And, oh, and there's another thing. You know, people were rewarded for having children, right? So the more children that you had, the fewer taxes you had to pay. And they also gave reimbursements back for mortgages. So by the time you had like four or five children, you know, you were paying like de minimis taxes, and you basically had a free house at that point.
Did they ever do away with interest? I forget.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was no usury. They had no interest, huh?
Yeah, well,
which is essentially Jewish.
Well, usury. charging someone for borrowing money is something that was created by the Jewish bankers. It was just a way for them to make money for doing nothing, really.
I almost have to apologize, don't I? The international bankers. I think, you know, Germany rebounded so quickly because of two simple and basic principles, blood and soil. I really think when you take care of a country like that, it makes all of the difference. And with the formation of National Socialism, I don't think originally they knew what they had created as it flourished into basically a religion in itself, and because it was modeled after nature, it couldn't go wrong. Perfect combination. A nature-based politics. The blood of your people and the land of your people.
And, you know, when you have a largely homogenous society, you do have, like, there are certain principles and morals, you know, that are essentially universal across that population. You know, when people talk about cultural enrichment and stuff like that, you know, you're introducing foreign cultures into a homogenous body. And those cultures are going to compete for supremacy. That, you know, that's just what happens, you know?
Happens everywhere. Happens in institutions when you lock different people up together, same shit.
And ironically, when they get there, they segregate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wonder why. I don't know. The forced integration is not working. And at what point do we get to pull the plug?
Well, and it's because they're, you know, people live by different standards, you know. And I'm not necessarily saying that any of them are better or worse, but certainly, you know, there are differences in how people believe, what people think is correct or upright behavior. And, you know, there are also groups of people that just don't care about any of that. They don't emphasize things like honor or, you know, etiquette. You know, those concepts are considered, you know, colonial or something. Right?
Yeah.
But that's just a marketplace reality. It's like when you have people that have such disparate views on,
well,
you know, how
we have people
should
with
conduct
disparate
themselves
views
in civilized
that,
society.
Regardless of color, you know, that's just a light one. We have people with those disparaging views, and it doesn't matter their color or their, you know, their race.
Well, but their culture does tend to play
a
role
culture,
in that.
Culture is a better word for it, I think. Culturally, we're different. I'm taking it as people have different faults and shit, and people have different ways of living, and that doesn't matter where you're from. There's trash, drug addicts, alcoholics, white people in black, purple, green, yellow.
Right, but I think, you know,
the way they live, meaning
like
culturally, right? Culturally, the way they live.
Well, and as our culture has morphed away from some of our traditional values, you see more and more of, you know, these behaviors amongst people that, you know, 50 years ago or 100 years ago, you wouldn't have seen that, you know?
Yes. Yes, and I think anytime you force anybody to do anything, it's never, ever going to work. It'll never be successful.
Right.
And here we are in the middle of it. When do we get to pull the plug? We don't. We're just along for the ride, hopefully making people aware at the least, right? It's what we do today that hopefully affects what the outcome is tomorrow.
Well, and I think that people need to look in a little more to the nuts and bolts of history and to see how, you know, things have changed under similar circumstances in the past. I mean, that was like the whole point of looking at, you know, the shifts that occurred between Weimar and National Socialism in Germany, is to see, you know, that was an example of a political shift. You know, there was no armed rebellion. That people voted the National Socialists into office. You know, and it's because they had become so desperate, you know, for change. And they weren't getting it under the socialist government that they had. It was just getting worse. Now, today, whether or not, you know, it's possible to create such a political solution is highly questionable. You know, simply because I think that people today are so much lower information than they were back then, you know? And people today are unwilling to do anything that they think might cause them some kind of, you know, struggle. They don't understand that life is struggle. You know, you weren't promised a free ride here. You weren't promised a stress-free life. And, you know, it's like you have to pull yourself up and figure it out. And I think that in today's society, so many people have gotten so reliant on a system providing for them and having some kind, you know, they think that there's some kind of panacea where, you know, they can go to college and get a white-collar job and make a lot of money and, you know, have a house on the hill or whatever, and, like, everybody can somehow do that. And it's easy, you know. That's not how life works.
Absolutely not. To solve it politically, it would take a movement, and it would take, as a friend of mine, James, says, a lot of shutting the F up, a lot of shutting the fuck up, and infiltrating what is already there, not LARPing like a National Socialist, but having the same standards and principles, and maybe even lying a little bit or not being as honest as you should until you get into places where you can make a difference. We don't want to do that. We're always right in the face of everybody openly playing neo-Nazi on a friggin' Zionist basketball court. It's like crazy. It's like one person and 150,000 football fans, and they're all Jewish, and you're standing down there in your football helmet ready to play a football game all by yourself.
Well, to be fair, though, and I think that this is something that, I mean, that's part of who we are as Europeans, you know? We tend to be overly honest, and we tend to be somewhat naive in that respect. But, you know, that's a carryover from the old days of, you know, blood and honor, you know? And, you know, within us, and certainly people who subscribe to National Socialist views believe in honor, believe in duty, you know? And it's hard to set those things aside for the purpose of subterfuge.
Sure. But you have to this is a life and death situation. You know, I was talking before, I think it's reflective of the product of man. I don't think we have men in society. I think they're a different kind of man than Generation X. I just think it's a lot different. It takes a different breed of people to do what they did. And there was, you know, different circumstances, and things were a little different. Perhaps the heart of it all was a little more primed than the United States, but we're right where they're at.
Well, and I guess the hope is that, you know, in the areas where the majority of us remain, that enough people will decide that a change needs to be made.
Yeah, you know, and I think we're doing a good thing. I think this think tank is a good thing. We shall see. What do you got for us next week?
Next week, I think we will probably either discuss further in the economic realm or discuss the transition period of, you know, the beginning of the war, possibly, you know, some of the stuff that was going on with Poland that resulted in the war being started prematurely, possibly.
Yeah, I think we should definitely cover the instigators, you know, set that up. How did the war start? The truthful... I'm not asking you, but we'll present how the war started, truthfully, from research and facts, of course. But there's always that out there too, you know. Nobody knows who actually started it. Nobody knows why. It's like, you know, everybody makes fun of Putin for getting on there with Carlson and telling the world history of Russia. But after you listen to him speak, he has his points. Same thing, yeah.
Well, and Vladimir Putin, you know, for his faults, is an erudite individual. I mean, you know, he's an educated man, and he presents himself that way. You know, he could talk circles around someone like Joe Biden or Kamala Harris.
I could talk circles around Joe Biden.
I mean, that's not saying a lot. I'm kidding. But yeah, he definitely could.
Yeah, you know, it's just the people that are running our administration right now are the intellectual dump trucks of the universe. You know?
Yeah, and that's I don't even want to go there. You'll have to get this letter for me. Can you send it to me? I want to put it on the website.
Oh, of course.
Quick link it in the chat and whatnot. I'll want to read it again. That was awesome. You think you could pull that off?
Oh yeah.
Cool.
That's what email is for.
Yeah. That's what email is for. You ready to wrap it up?
I am.
All righty. No music going out. I'm not editing this. Did you? And I'll stay on when we're gone, I guess.
Okay.
All right. Sign us off.
All right. Have a great week.
Have a great week, everybody. You've been listening to Blood and Honor. Excuse me, Blood and Soil. Said that a lot back in the day. Blood and Soil, Fireside Chat. I'm your host, Swamp Cracker, and this is...
And I'm Elsa.
And she's Elsa. We'll see y'all next week. Thank you for listening.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.